those guys were the son of the Salvatore's guy. So that's how you know.
This
yeah.
is too it's good. Deeply Halifax.
Just start the show, Jacob.
Welcome back to Box Office Bylines, a podcast about movies and sometimes TV shows about journalism. The headlines, the deadlines, the insiders, and the train wrecks. I am Jacob Boone, a journalist in Yellowknife Northwest Territories, joined as always by...
Tara Thornton, Halifax.
Tara, we started this podcast a little over a year ago. Mm. And when we did, you had two rules. One was that it should always be fun. If it stopped being fun, we should stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And
here we
two
still are.
Was that we weren't ever going to talk about Sex and the City. And we're breaking at least one of those rules today. We'll see if we break the first one, too.
Yeah.
Sex and the City. 1998 to 2004, and then 2008, and then 2010, and then 2013 to 2014 prequel series, and then 2021 ongoing.
Minus Kim Cattrall.
Yes. Created by Darren Star, starring Sarah Jessica Parker, Kim Cattrall for most of it, Kristen Davis, Cynthia Nixon, and of course the City of New York, and many, 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 many guest men.
Mm-hmm. Primarily
over the years.
Chris Noth.
And... Well, let me
and
ask you
what's
this, Tara.
His face? John Corbett. Yeah.
Yeah. You. We'll get into this, actually, why you don't like this show. But first, why don't we bring in our special guest?
Yes.
Because this was her idea. Not to blame her. I'm fine with the show. I have no strong feelings one way or the other. She is a writer, editor, and podcaster who's produced shows for HuffPost Canada, the Ryerson Review of Journalism, and TVO. Currently working with Vocal Fry Studios, Michal Stein. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Hello. Thanks for being
us.
Here.
You're in Toronto.
I am in Toronto.
One of our favorite cities.
It's a beautiful day here. Mm-hmm, sun is shining. Mm-hmm. Air conditioner is off.
Off. Wow.
First That's... off, that you have an air conditioner. Great job.
Thank you. I needed it because I could not sleep. And it was only May. So that is Toronto.
Why I can't live there. I can't, like, people, I've been asked many times over the years, and it's like, well, now I can't afford it. But, like, but before it was like, why don't you move to Toronto? It's like, this summer would kill me dead.
And summer in Halifax is too beautiful. It is the nicest time. And summer in Toronto, while fun, is extremely hot. So,
it's not that great in Halifax.
I had
Halifax
a nice time.
Can have bad summers too.
Yeah, we can. So far, it's okay.
Anyway, that's speaking of life in the city. Yes. As I said, I think, Michal, you wanted to talk about Sex and the City. You got a book from the library about this. You've done an incredible amount of research and seem to have a lot of knowledge to go with. But why this series?
I am about to admit something incredibly embarrassing about myself, but it is true. So I will say it, which is that. So Sex and the City came out while I was a little bit too young to watch it, but I started watching it when I was in middle school at kind of as it was ending. And, you know, in my parents' basement, my mom was okay with it. My dad was not. We hid that from him. That was fun. And I was so entranced by that world that that was maybe the first show that made me think, oh, maybe I want to be a journalist. Like, maybe that's the world I want to be in. It was Sex and the City. It was 13 going on 30.
Heyo. And, yeah.
And then it was All the President's Men. And
the Holy Trinity.
Yes. So we really get the whole, you know, the whole run of it. And that show was so formative to me as a person, partially because I was so young when I first watched it. Anything you watch at that age becomes formative in one way or another, for better or worse. But in, you know, this endless year of quarantine, it's also been a show that I have revisited now for the kind of bazillionth time, but the first time as an adult from kind of beginning to end. I haven't allowed myself to watch the last two episodes because I can't get there yet. And I know what's happening, but I can't do it. And it's been really interesting to think about the way that it kind of shaped my ideas about dating and about kind of like life as a single woman in the city, which, you know, is my life. And I always kind of imagined like, yes, I can't wait until I'm, you know, successful and hang out with my friends. And I like go out on a Friday night and then I like meet some man and he's dumb, but I entertain him for a while. And like, that was like, as a very young person, the conception of what I thought my life would be. And in some ways it is. So, it's just been an interesting reflection. And also since, you know, I've been kind of doing work as a journalist for, if we include school, like 4-ish years, it's interesting to be able to critique Carrie in that respect as well.
Well, that was my main question. Now that you are a working journalist, how do you feel about how journalism is portrayed?
I think the industry as a whole is portrayed in a very, I don't know if it's necessarily, I think it's actually kind of is a bit realistic in some ways. In that particular world, like, I don't think it that's not Toronto. That's not journalism in Toronto. That's probably not journalism anywhere in Canada, because there's not, like, no one has that money. The money is such a big part of it. But when I think about, like, right, those worlds are so small, like the publishing and the magazines and the you know, smaller newspapers and whatever, and that everyone's kind of moving in those circles. Everyone kind of knows each other. That does seem to be, you know, maybe how it was, if it's not. And it kind of seems how it is. Like, I mean, journalism now also exists on Twitter, and like, you know, that's a thing too. There are like weird little scenes, and
yeah, you can see all the people who talk to each other. Like, I realize that I follow them. Like, when I find someone new, I'm like, oh, they're friends with these people.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's totally true. Yeah.
So there is that kind of weird little insidery sensibility as well. So I think in terms of the industry, that kind of feels true to me. But in terms of Carrie as a journalist, I mean, first of all, I feel like columnists don't exist in the same way as they did at that time. And also, I mean, what's funny to me is that she kind of like starts out, her column is all, you know, an important feature all the way through, but you see her really doing the work in the first season. You see her like, I'm a like sexual anthropologist. I'm gonna go out and like see what everyone's doing and see what the trends are. And then she kind of just like makes it about herself, and it just becomes a like Carrie dating column and not.
Yeah, and I want Tara, I want to get your thoughts in a second, but that's my memory of the show, was that the first season or two. And truthfully, I sporadically watched it when it was on, I think on Bravo, it was here in Canada, and I have not revisited it since, but my memory is like, it started off as an interesting show that had a lot to say, and then it kind of quickly, as it gained in popularity, just sort of became a parody of itself almost, or just focused solely on wacky dating hijinks and puns and shoes.
Oh, the puns. Okay.
But again, I'm not a fan. I didn't see a lot. So Tara, why do you hate this show?
Why do I hate this show? Okay. You know, I love New York stuff. I love shows set in New York. Felicity, for instance. I love New York. But this is the sort of corner of New York that I don't like. I'm like the sort of the New York that was portrayed in a different Michael Patrick King show, Younger, you know, like the Brooklyn kind of like hard scrabble side, as opposed to the high end fashion, which is just not an interest of mine. Money side, whatever. But my main problem is, I think gay men are the worst people to write women. No one knows less. Actually, Michael Patrick King also ran, like, all had his little writing team on Younger, and I thought the women were written really terribly on Younger as well. But then I extend that to Ryan Murphy, a literal monster. It's just like, it's not how women talk to me. And not talk to me personally. Like, to me, it's not how women sound. And what Jacob said about the puns, like, just all these little, like, quips. This is like gay men talking, but they put it in women's mouths. And I don't know. I just find it super on the nose. It's super over sexualized. And it's just like not, it's not my tempo. That's all. I am someone that appreciates a show with four female leads, and like most of them are over 40, or ended up over 40 in the run eventually. So, you know, like I'm inherently for it, but I just think the team behind it didn't work for me. So I just never watched it.
I would say those are all very fair critiques of the show. But what I will say is that while Michael Patrick King did, was a writer on the show, the writing team actually was mostly women and occasionally one straight man. And there is, if I know, it's funny. So I was reading this book. Sometimes you just
like, who was it? Did they just grab someone off the street?
Yes. Essentially. I was just like literally reading about this yesterday where they're like, we need to make our male characters a little better rounded. Maybe we should ask a straight man about men. But I was reading this book, or kind of perusing this book, called Sex in the City and Us, by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong, who has also written books about Seinfeld. And I'd kind of heard the lore of the writing of this show before, but I've heard it kind of mixed. It was told to me that like the writers of the show all used to live kind of downtown in the West Village, and they would get, and the writers' room was in Queens, so they would all get picked up by this van, and they would sit and they would talk about what they did on the weekend, and that would become the fodder for what happened on the show. And so someone once told me, they said, everything that happened on the show happened to the writers. And I said, I don't think that's true. I think that some of the, like, offshoots did, some of the hijinks did, but like you can't track the relationship of like Carrie and Big through mm-hmm. someone's kind of misjointed misadventures. But it was, in fact, this book would have all the women's names. I don't have them off the top of my head, but no, it was a group of women, and it was there were women added to it, and a lot of So while, you know, not everything that happened in the show necessarily happened to one of them or their friends, a lot of it was taken from their real life experiences of dating in New York. And an interesting thing that I read is that pretty much all of the writers were single for the duration of the show. And they were all women in their kind of like 20s and 30s. So very similar to the characters themselves. And one of them said she couldn't get married until after the show was over because she was so like dedicated to the show. But I think where the kind of like the feeling of, oh, this is a show written about women by gay men, I think that comes from Michael Patrick King, who mm-hmm. I think takes, or, you know, would take all the stories and take the scripts and then punch them up, is my feeling. So because Samantha really is written almost like a drag queen at times. I don't know. I don't know any woman that sounds like Samantha, but there are some sensibilities. I think what I love about the show and what, here's my other book that I read that has a great essay about Sex and the City, Emily Nussbaum's book.
Oh, yeah. Nussbaum's the legend. Yeah.
And she just wrote a really fantastic essay about Sex and the City back in 2013. And what she kind of taps into that really resonates with me as like a lover of television is that it's like high femininity, glitter, and the kind of fantasy. Like it's funny that you mentioned Younger, because I also watched most of Younger. I haven't watched the latest season.
Me either. I can't bring myself to do it.
Also, I can't get back into my dad's Amazon Prime account, so crucial if I need to, if I'm going to try and watch Younger. And I really, like, I agree. Those characters feel so weirdly flat to me. And even, like, I think the reason that I like the Manhattan of Sex and the City better than I like the Brooklyn of Younger is that because Manhattan is this kind of, like, fantasy land, the high fantasy of Sex and the City fits for me, whereas the Brooklyn of Younger, which is supposed to be like grittier and whatever, feels a little bit inauthentic to me. Whereas it feels like they're trying to go for authenticity.
And where, when you were talking about Nussbaum, actually, you reminded me that she wrote a great profile about Girls in its first year as well. And that is a show, that is what I that's what I meant. I know I said Felicity first, but really Girls is what I meant. It's
like, and I would, I totally would agree with Felicity's you about Girls. Yeah. Girls, when it was, like, when it came out, and I, like, it, that's a show that came out when I was, like, basically that age. So it was, like, so intense for me. Or I was like, Shosha's age. And so that was a show where I was like, oh, my God, there I am, or there I will be. And there I wasn't, maybe, but.
Yes. I mean, Jacob, maybe we can do Girls one of these days because, you know, Hannah ends up working in advertorial. That's something that we can all relate to. That's
tangentially close. Yeah.
Yep.
You know, I think it wouldn't have been such a cultural juggernaut if there wasn't something here that didn't speak
to women. Oh, for sure. And people love Sarah Jessica Parker. They just love, like, they love that team of women.
Like, it, you know, maybe it was very, I think very, Sex and the City was very much of its moment, which maybe is why, I don't know. Mikhail, you said, like, going back, like, it wasn't too well received at the time, but definitely there seems to have been in the last, like, 5-6 years, a turning point where now Carrie is the villain of the show.
Yes. Well, and to go back to Emily Nussbaum, that's what she says, is that, you know, Carrie is our first real female antihero. And she, which she totally is, because, and this is what's been interesting about having watched it as a preteen and watching it again now. You know, as a preteen, I was like, oh yeah, all these, like, men are so shitty. Like, they are, like, how could they do that to her? And now I'm watching it and realizing, like, oh, she's, you know, totally neurotic, in the early seasons particularly, totally neurotic, totally reading into things that don't exist and not actually just asking the question, like, doing all these things that, like, no wonder you're having trouble. Like, these are things, these are bad habits. and I think it was written that way. I think, and it can only be, this is probably how women at the time were watching it and not 12-year-olds. 12-year-old. I didn't understand anything, but I learned a lot. I'm going to try and find, I think I marked where they talked about the reception. Because, here we go. This is what Newsday's Steve Parks said about the series. This is from Sex and the City and Us. He called it so self-consciously arch in its attempt to be hip about relationships that it comes across as far more sophomoric than sophisticated. It's not enough anymore to have women sitting around talking about doing it. Where's the novelty in that as we approach the end of the millennium? Parks went on to describe Samantha as, excuse the expression, a slut. I take issue with this review in many ways because, first of all, when you think about it, of its time, it was actually groundbreaking in that it was really giving agency to female sexuality and and airing those conversations. I think about all the time, there's an episode in season one where someone asks Charlotte if she'll do anal and she's, like, freaking out about it, and they, like, all get into a cab and they, like, have this whole dissection of, like, what does this mean? What does this mean for you? Like, you know, and that it, even though some of their conversations were totally bombastic and the language sometimes and the way that they talked to each other felt maybe, you know, overdone, it was also not in the public sphere at all. And I think the reason why it maybe some of it feels a bit dated now is that we do have a lot more of that. And some of that is in podcasting and shows like Call Her Daddy or, you know, any of those shows that, are, you know, women just have more places to have those conversations.
I think it's interesting to track, like, how female, like, sexuality and has been goes to portrayed from Sex and the City to, like, Girls to something like Euphoria today, and critically how that gets received and changed from probably a lot of, you know, middle-aged dude writers in the 90s who, yeah, didn't really want to see women being sexual on their own terms in media. When at the same time, like, Entourage was around the same time, but I'm trying to think of something
later,
I have to imagine that factored into the reception.
Yeah.
From a TV critic stack.
Yeah, exactly. Just a show about women, it doesn't matter what they're doing. It's just not going to be considered high art or like prestige television.
Until it becomes so massively popular, you can't ignore it. You have to find...
I will say, like, their conceptions of female sexuality feel very dated to me to watch now. Like, it's incredibly biphobic. It's transphobic. Like, all sorts of things that just feel so, like, holy shit, this... I can't believe that this was on television, but it was so, I guess, at the time, wasn't seen as anything. Like, you know, it was what
it
was.
Yeah. The times were different.
Yeah.
So in preparation for this, we watched three episodes, two from season four, dealing with Carrie's financial woes, which forced her.
We can
get into the economy of being a writer in a second. That forced her to write for Vogue and subsequent at-work harassment. And then the season five episode, also with Candace Bergen as her...
Murphy Brown herself, my journalistic
as her editor,
hero.
Yes. Where she has her book launch. There's a lot of weird... Like, there was a store clerk that just dropped a couple ethnics... Like... One ethnic slur and then one use of faggot, just casually.
I thought it was faglet.
Is that a
word? Do you remember which store that was? I just watched those episodes too, but I can't remember.
When,
a shoe store, right?
No, it was Charlotte. Sorry, I don't know the names off the top of my head.
Yeah.
When Charlotte's trying to pawn her, not pawn, but get her wedding ring reset.
Yes, yes, yes. Oh, they dropped so many. That was not.
There were all these scenes where today it would be something entirely different the way you're viewing it and the way it's set up. When Samantha and her boyfriend she's going to set up a threesome.
Oh yeah.
With this younger waitress, and it's entirely about like Samantha's fears and jealousy. And then they get to the threesome and her boyfriend has some insecure moment because the girl calls her daddy, and so they just literally boot
her
out of the bed.
They throw her on the ground,
and it's supposed to be like, wow, Samantha won, and not like you have an incredibly insecure weirdo boyfriend. And also today I feel like Samantha and the waitress would have found a connection and cut the dude out of the
right.
That would have been how that's written.
That would have been the new, you're right, it would have been like, oh, it backfired on Richard or whatever. But when he, you're right.
So we get a tidbit in that. So the episodes that we're talking about in particular, that was season four, Ring-a-Ding-Ding. So Aiden and Carrie have just split up. They were engaged. Aiden had bought Carrie's apartment for her because her building was going co-op. And then Carrie needs to buy it back from him.
Right.
And doesn't have the money.
He gives her the choice to leave or
buy it from him.
Buy the apartment.
And so that's Ring-a-Ding-Ding. The following episode is A Vogue Idea, which is where Carrie starts at Vogue. And then the season five episode was Plus One is the Loneliest Number, which is Carrie's book launch. So there's a really interesting piece of information that we learn in Ring-a-Ding-Ding that to me was like, this is the answer when everyone says, how can Carrie live on a writer's salary, like live like she does on a writer's salary? And we find out that her rent in what's supposed to be the Upper West Side is in fact, it's shot in the West Village. You can walk by the apartment. I have done it many times. My sister lives down the street from where they shoot. She walked on the set last week when they're shooting the new show. And we find out she's been paying $750 a month.
Yeah.
And for a beautiful studio apartment in the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. And that rent, I mean, barely exists anywhere. Like, I mean, I'm sitting here in Toronto also paying criminally low rent. Very, you know, by the skin of my teeth, like lucky to find this kind of place. But it barely exists. And it makes a huge difference.
It certainly didn't exist in the year 2000 or whatever, 2003 or whatever we're in for this. Yeah.
Yeah. Some, but she has $40,000 in shoes.
Oh, see, this is where I go. This is where I drop. It goes sideways for me. I'm like, she's like, I spent $40,000 on shoes. I had no idea.
Oh, like, yeah.
You're an idiot. And I love sneakers. Listen, I get it.
What I will say is that it actually does. It could have existed because it was a rent controlled apartment.
Oh, and, right. Rent control. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've learned about New York rent control in the last couple of years as I've had friends kind of move in and out and around. And there are places, like I have a friend whose family friend has been living in the Apthorpe, i.e. the place that Nora Ephron lived, which is rent control. Yes,
great
Harper.
Essay about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. I love her essay about the Apthorpe. And
the key money. Yeah.
Yeah. And but that's the thing, is it was rent controlled. And so she has a family friend who has, like, her parents moved there in the 60s or whatever. They're paying for, I visited and I stayed there. They're paying nothing for, like, a giant, I don't know how many bedroom, but it feels like a mansion. Absolutely beautiful. And it's the Apthorpe, but you never leave. Like, that's the thing. And then your rent right. gets kept. So it is actually feasible that Carrie could have been paying $750. But that's the thing, is it's like, you got the rent control or you don't.
Yeah.
So
the finance stuff, and I'd love to talk about, like, you know, being smart financially when you're a freelance journalist. Not a skill they really teach in journalism school. That's kind of important to figure out. Yeah, Carrie has no money. She spends it all on shoes. Now, I looked into some of this. So the series was based on Candace Bushnell's column and book. She eventually turned into a book. She was writing as a sex columnist for the New York Observer. Bushnell was paid $1,000 per column in the mid-90s. It was actually $250 more than other columnists at the Observer. So that would be $1,700 per column today. For a week or for a month.
and then adjust for inflation. That's like...
Carrie negotiates when she goes to freelance for Vogue. She negotiates a $4.50 per word rate, which would be $6.50 today adjusted for inflation. So for her 500-word front-of-book article about fall accessories, she would have been paid $3,200.
That is insane to me. Like, and
when she can't do that for some reason. She really struggles with that.
She
that,
really just needed to do, like, 1 month of freelancing at her rate, and she would have been able to afford the down payment on her apartment.
That was actually, watching that episode is almost upsetting when she goes, so this is, we're now in a Vogue idea. She's at Vogue. She writes this, like, cute little piece about how... which accessories are like which type of men, and like, oh, what man can go with which outfit. Cute idea, but as Candace Bushnell, sorry, not Candace Bushnell, Candace Bergen, as her editor, Enid, I think, says, it's not Vogue. This isn't Vogue. And it's like, no, when they're paying you that much, you have to just do the article. Like,
okay, no. Sorry, what? But this stuck to me that presumably Carrie's, if not famous, she's a known name. She's on buses. You're hiring a columnist and paying them that much. You're hiring their name, their personality. You would want that in the article. The idea of being like, I don't want you're in this. Maybe at Vogue, but then why would Vogue hire? Like, you do want that persona to shine through in the writing, because that's really what you're paying for.
My favorite part was how she went to a meeting. They had a meeting about this between her and the man and Murphy Brown to be like, we don't like it. Like, I'm sorry, the email existed then, right?
And Carrie like, shows up in the, like, Hildy Johnson striped power suits.
Yeah, and it's so she can get drunk in the office and then see the closet. I get it. Yeah. But, like, they just could have, like, had a better reason for her to be there than for them to be like, yeah, we got your story, we don't like it. Like, I'm sorry, that's not an in-person meeting.
She gets fall over drunk on 1.5 martinis, I think they said. And yes. They're also room temperature martinis.
Yeah.
He just pours vodka into a glass and spritzes it with vermouth.
Yeah. No ice.
So much of that scene was baffling.
Yeah. Oh, he's such a weird character, too. And I couldn't remember. I was watching it back, and I've now seen it enough times that I have, like, enough of an imprint to be like, he's so nice, but there's something off about him. Like, yeah. What's off about him? Why is... I'm supposed to like him, but there's something weird. And then at the end, he, like, takes her into the incredible, like, Vogue closet. Love a backstage peek into a magazine closet, as we got in Devil Wears Prada. Amazing, those scenes. And she tries on these Manolo Blahnik Mary Janes, I think. Really beautiful, whatever, beautiful little shoes. And she comes out and he has dropped his pants and says, mm-hmm. Tell me what you think about these boxers. And he's like obviously trying to make a move on her and she's repulsed. And that I thought was interesting to see the way that they played that and how that would be played now. Oh my God.
Like she's, it's not like Carrie's like, oh, this is awkward. She's like repulsed.
Yeah.
Horrified. And the music is this happy, upbeat samba thing.
They're trying to make it funny.
It's wacky.
Yeah.
Yeah. She literally can't run away because her shoes don't fucking fit.
Yeah.
It was very odd.
It was so odd. And maybe, like, that character was also very, in some ways, he was very, like, non-threatening. It's like, he's the kind of guy that's like, I could take him out. Like, but it.
Well,
didn't
they play up? There was a lot of talk about, like.
About his wife.
That like, Carrie was writing about men because of her own father issues.
Yes.
And he's an older man. And so, like.
Yes.
I think they were trying to be like, look, he's the father figure taking her under her wing. But actually, oh, no, he just wants sex.
Yeah, he's just being creepy. But then. Yes, it was totally weird, and it would have been nice if they could have given her a father figure and not made it weird, but they did.
Yeah.
But then I guess the interesting thing out of that is that we get Candace Bergen, and we get back to, okay, Candace Bergen's not going to, like, hold her hand and tell her how special she is, but she's going to be a good editor. Like, she's going to edit her, and we get her... later in the season or later
and
in the
and that lunch they have together was like amazing.
I know.
I did enjoy that.
No editor's gonna like for this freelance rando, you're not gonna be like tailing her around the office.
No, like Anna Wintour's next person down has nothing to do with this section.
Yeah, the financial stuff.
It's so
and when she yells at Charlotte for not offering her the money.
Oh yeah.
Like,
and then
the
rips
nerve.
Up the no strings attached check from Big. I also couldn't understand why none of these people from Big to her lawyer or PR friends could just co-sign a loan.
That's a great question. That they trust.
It seemed
her
like
enough.
There were a lot of options
yeah.
aside from being homeless. And she
yes.
also just doesn't want to move. She goes and sees an apartment, and yes, it's more expensive, but she's also like disgusted that there's a curry takeout beneath
yeah.
her because of the smell.
Yeah.
When now that would be like something that jacks the rent up that you
right.
like should take out below you.
Go get dinner. Don't
yeah.
have to. Don't
you
have
get
to
the samosas at the end of the day.
Yeah. Dream come true.
Yes.
Yeah, it is weird that they trust her enough. Multiple people trust her enough to give her a loan, but they don't trust her enough to just co-sign the apartment.
Yeah.
I will say, I think I appreciated that she ripped up Big's check because there's no such thing as no strings attached check from Big. There are strings.
Metaphorically, but like, he didn't offer a contract. Like, you could just take that money, Carrie. Like, there's no... She's like, I have to pay him back, but if there's no paperwork...
It's not just about the money. It's about the...
I know.
It's about what it says. She's doing it on her own. But she couldn't do it on her own, obviously. but yes, that was very bad friend alert, going to Charlotte and yelling at her for not offering her
$30,000. Oh my God, yeah.
Imagine. I would
die in the
street.
The book release party where she begs Samantha like kowtows her to come out, even though her face is peeled off from a chemical peel, and then gets mad at her and like sends her home as quickly as
yes.
Although all of the Samantha face jokes at the party were very funny. I enjoyed all of that content.
One of my favorite lines is "You look like beef carpaccio." Amazing. Amazing.
Kim Cattrall
line. I've never
really
forgotten that.
I'm sad. I understand why she's not in the revival for all the, I guess, bad blood, but really kind of the star and the most enjoyable character and acting in the whole thing.
In some ways, one of the most interesting character arcs. Like, they really do her dirty in a lot of ways, but she had, like, there are such interesting little details about her throughout the, sorry, this has nothing to do with journalism. I just find Samantha really interesting. Like, really interesting details about maybe things about her past. There's some allusion to a childhood where it was like a little bit rough, and she's like come to New York and like she's really a self-made woman in a, similar to the way that Miranda is as well. But also, like, you know, out of all of them, owns her sexuality the most. And but there's such a, there are moments where we get such tenderness from her and also such vulnerability, and that a lot of the like oversexedness of her is a shield. And then that we get Smith Jared, who, well, the man she turns into Smith Jared, the like hot young actor, to be the one to like let her soften a little bit, I think is quite a lovely, a lovely transition for her.
I think that probably speaks to the writer's room. Like, sometimes the side character who's initially just there for color becomes the more interesting actor and character to write for, and so you end up developing that, whereas your lead just on paper becomes like, okay, which boyfriend is she going to have this season?
Yeah.
And sadly, that's what the show ended on, I think. That was... She just kind of went back to New York with Big.
I don't know. Although what's interesting is that there is a moment in season six where she's like, you know, together with Mikhail Baryshnikov as Alexander Petrovsky. Sorry, Alexander Petrovsky. He like makes a big deal. Alexander. She says like, okay, well, if I'm going to go to Paris with him, then I can't be a writer anymore. And that's really interesting because, well, first of all, if there's any job that you can travel with, like that you can take wherever, like it's being a writer. Like, you can write from anywhere.
Paris, famously a city not of writers.
No, no one writes anything there.
There's just
not poems.
No inspiration.
Not the review.
No.
No,
there's
community.
No review of books there.
They don't read. There's no... like lovely, charming bookstores where they hire writers to work for a month as long as they write something, they can sleep there. Shakespeare and Company. you know, why does Carrie have to give up writing to go to Paris? Makes no sense to me. But it is, I guess, this interesting, she said, it does set up this dichotomy of like, if she chooses path A with Alexander, she has to like give up part of herself. But at this point, after all the like heartbreak and whatever, Big will allow her to be herself. And that, I think, is in fact not very empowering, because can't she just do what she wants? But
I have a question for a super fan. Tara, have you watched the movies?
No.
Okay.
Why would I? No.
No. Mika, have you?
I have. I hate them.
Well, Lindy West famously got... Lindy West got famous off her Sex and the City 2 review. That's where her
It is one of the worst movies ever made, I think.
Career-wise, is Carrie still a columnist in these stories? Or is that just so faded in the background that it doesn't matter?
That's a great question. Those are movies... Like, I love revisiting movies, and I love revisiting Sex and the City, and in my mind, the movies don't exist because they're so terrible. The first one... slightly less terrible than the second. There are a few episodes of Sex and the City that I refuse to go back to because they are so, like, make me feel ill. season finale of season three, I tell people not to watch, and I don't watch it because it's so that what it's like whorephobic, transphobic, just like no one should watch it, and it's a real stain on the show. But and that I feel similarly about Sex and the City too, like just so racist and not good. But good question: is she a journalist? Let's find out.
In the movies, does it have the narration that sort of sets up the plot, or do they just abandon that concept?
I don't think they do, because it's really
interesting. Because the show, like, that's such a fundamental feature of the show, is Carrie's voice, her dumb, punny narration and cliches.
I always think about the one where she can't think of anything to write, and she gets to, men are socks.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
We've all had that, like, first draft.
Okay.
You just start with something bad, and you kind of, you figure it out later.
Yeah.
On revision.
Absolutely. I love those episodes when Carrie can't figure out what to write. I think that's very funny. I just Googled Sex and the City 1, and apparently the plot, so the going into it, Big has asked her, or maybe he asks her to marry her in the movie. Yes, they do get engaged as part of the movie. Blah, blah, blah. Carrie is asked by her Vogue editor, Enid, Candace Bergen, to do a spread for Vogue called The Last Single Girl. She gets to dress up in fancy couture gowns, this is all from Wikipedia, and is gifted a gown from Vivian Westwood, which she decides to wear instead of her suit. Oh yeah, that's the other thing that I was thinking of. Like, the real draw to being, to like the idea of Carrie as a character is imagining all the stuff that people give her. she must get such good stuff.
Yeah.
Why does she have to pay for the shoes? Why don't they just send her the shoes?
Yeah.
At some point.
I guess if you're not a fashion columnist. Well, she's not. Right. She's a dating sex columnist.
Maybe she'd get, like, her vibrators.
Yeah.
Which, you know, expensive, but maybe not.
They are expensive. Yeah.
As much as shoes. Sell them. That's true. Actually.
So in the revival, do you think she's still... like 20 years of being a newspaper columnist? Or do you
no,
think
she'll be
she's
like,
going to be just an author, right?
She'll have a Substack.
Yes, Carrie would. Because she can't work with editors. She, like, has...
She's gone full, like, Glenn Greenwald, like...
Yeah.
Turfy, like...
Oh, you know what?
Very...
Carrie's got a podcast. She's so used to narrating. She's got a podcast. Yeah, but she doesn't talk to anyone else. It's just her.
Yeah.
It's just her musing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I think she's, I am curious to see what they do with her, because the kind of interesting question for me is, like, how could someone who has, like, so been so emblematic of a specific time and place, that they've come to symbolize it, and the world has moved on to different, the world is a different place than it was 15 years ago, more than that, when the show ended, you know, what's her place in the world? And, like, does anyone care what she has to say anymore? And, like, I mean, it's not like she would have the pulse on, like, dating trends. I was thinking about it, because I don't feel like dating columnists are as much of a thing. Like, there's still people that kind of write about whatever.
Their babies would be, like, what, 16 now? Age. So I'm sure that'll factor in.
Yeah, that's something. True. I mean, I think that what is actually a really interesting area of exploration that has been a little bit explored, but I think it's quite rich, is second marriages and divorces. And what do you do after your, like, dream partner is not your dream partner anymore and you get divorced? And everyone gets divorced. Like, I mean, I shouldn't say everyone gets divorced, but a lot of people get divorced.
Half.
Yeah. And I think there's so much richness to exploring. I mean, I'm saying this as, like, a 29-year-old woman who is, like, I've never been married and have no immediate plans to be. But but I'm also, you know, a child of divorce, and I've seen my parents go through it, and I've seen, you know, many people in my life kind of go through exploring what that second act looks like. And that, I think there are a lot of interesting things if they can do it well. and to talk about another, you know, very well-paid journalist, Taffy Broadusser Ackner, I think, did a great job in Fleischman Is in Trouble of exploring that. So Sex and the City could do that, but then they would have to say goodbye. I just can't lose Steve. I know Miranda and Steve have had their troubles before, and they have been separated in one of the movies or both. I don't remember. And they were, you know, apart for a lot of the show. But I love Steve. Steve is, I think, my favorite. Of the long-term partners, I think Steve is my favorite.
I just want to say Taffy deserves her word rate, and Carrie does not.
That's a very... she is an amazing profile writer. I love her profiles. I hope that...
And she even puts herself in them, which I normally hate, but she does it in a way that I love. Katie Weaver does the same thing.
The Bradley Cooper one? Oh, my God. I love that profile. I think about it all the time.
Yeah, and Val Kilmer she did as well, right?
Oh, I haven't read that one.
Oh, yeah. Highly recommend.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a break there?
Come back with
some trivia.
I had just submitted my first freelance article for one of the most relevant and provocative magazines on the newsstands today, at least to me. Vogue, also known as Mecca, where I belong.
This isn't Vogue.
Oh, you didn't like it?
No, no one is saying that.
Well, I am. I'll say it. I didn't like it there. I said it.
No, what Enid is trying to say, Carrie, is that you wrote a wonderful first draft.
That isn't Vogue.
There it was. The article I'd put my heart and soul into. And it was bleeding.
Your spin on the idea, Carrie, is very clever. Different types of men as the new accessories for fall. A Prada dress should always be worn with an investment banker. I mean, that's wonderful.
Julian, the assignment was 500 words on accessories, not men. And I'm not convinced she knows anything about purses, or for that matter, men.
Enid, for the love of God.
Miss Bradshaw, what you've handed us here is essentially just your newspaper column with the word style jammed in where the word sex used to be. We're not looking for Vogue according to your agenda. No one cares about your agenda.
That's not true.
Oh, forgive me. I don't care about your agenda. I care about designers. Oscar de la Renta, Chanel, Dior. I want less Carrie Bradshaw and more Carrie this bag with these shoes. Do you see what I mean? You're a writer. You should be writing this down.
I was trying to find a way to introduce the bags and the bracelets with a little humor. Kind of Men Are the New Black. It was supposed to be funny.
It was supposed to be bags.
Welcome back to Box Office Bylines, where we're discussing the aspirational journalism, aspirational columnism of Sex and the City.
I have a minor correction, though not really. A note from my partner that the Paris Review of Books is based in New York City, but...
Did she text you that?
Yes, she did, from the other room.
Hi, Katie.
Was established in Paris in 1953 before moving offices to New York in 73.
Okay.
So I'm technically correct, which, as we all know, is the best kind of correct.
Yes.
Yes. So that's why Carrie can't be a writer in Paris, because the Paris Review of Books is in New York.
There you go.
So obviously this is a long-standing franchise with tons of stuff we could talk about, but I just pulled a couple odd little things. I don't know if either of you know the famous story of the medicine cabinet in Carrie's apartment.
No.
Which is seen in every episode, maybe. First spied by Sarah Jessica Parker at a flea market shortly before filming began on the series, she and Matthew Broderick didn't buy it, but reconsidered, and then when they went back, the cabinet was already sold to some television show.
Ah.
She showed up to filming, and there it was. And I believe
she wanted it for her own house.
I think she took it with her when the series ended.
Wow. Oh, I love that.
I don't remember the medicine cabinet as being anything special.
A medicine cabinet. All I can think of is her bathroom.
Hmm.
The medicine cabinet? What does that look like? I'm Googling it.
The show was shot on 16mm film for its entire run.
That's weird.
For its sixth and final season, 35mm film was requested but turned down by HBO due to the increased cost.
I was going to say, that's expensive.
It's very expensive. But I believe,
and I think I realized this, because during the pandemic, last spring, summer, I was rewatching Sopranos, and Katie, my partner, was rewatching Sex and the City, and I noticed that I think Sopranos wasn't high def, but Sex and the City was, and I was like, that's weird that they would put the time in to convert one and not the other. But I think because it was 16 millimeter, it was cheaper to do that upscale conversion, do another run of it. So that may have extended its life on streaming.
That's very interesting.
I hate high def. When there's like, you know, there's like the high def channel. It's like, I don't want it.
No,
it's too. I don't want a 4K TV. It's too, the def is too high. Yeah. I don't want it. I don't want to watch a play.
According to the casting directors, people considered or were in the running for the role of Carrie Bradshaw included Carrie Ann Moss, Lisa Eldestein from House, Melora.
Lisa Eldestein, that's a weird one.
Melora Hardin.
From oh, Melora Hardin. Yeah, that would have been great.
Jan.
And Brenda Strong.
Wow. What a weird smear of people.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because I mean, I think everybody so associates Carrie with Sarah Jessica Parker. And there's so much about her physically that they play off of. Like when Big and Natasha gets married and Carrie has a whole The Way We Were moment. And she goes and sees them leaving the plaza and she walks up to him and goes, "Your girl is lovely, Hubble." And she gets to have her like Barbara Streisand moment. It's like, yeah, no, Sarah Jessica Parker can do that. Not everyone can do that.
Yeah. Melora Hardin, less so.
No.
The real life Mr. Big was the then publisher of Vogue, Ron Galati, Candace Bushnell's boss's boss.
Wow.
She would show him her columns before publishing, and he would often respond, according to her, by saying, "Cute, baby, cute."
Cool.
There's also an alternate version of the opening credits, not just because they took the World Trade Center out after 9/11, but they also filmed a version where instead of wearing the pink tutu dress, she's in like a blue something number. And instead of being splashed because they couldn't wait or afford the bus for a second, like the other half day of filming, they just had her kind of trip and stumble, but correct herself.
Did they ever show that sequence?
I don't believe so. It maybe it's on a DVD.
You know how like when you'd be watching TV and then one day it'd be like the Fresh Prince extended theme?
Oh, yeah.
And it felt like such a treat.
Or they do special like variant credits.
Or the credits like when Courtney Cox married David Arquette and they all added Arquette to the end of their names.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are always great. You're just like,
oh, TV. Yeah. It's very cute. Yeah.
So I hope they did that one time. I hope it's somewhere out there.
We should hopefully write to them, see if they'll send it to us.
Do you have the blue credits version?
Yeah, that's all I have.
That's it.
Well, there's so much to talk about. I didn't want to go like there's essays of stuff. It's true. People can go look it up.
There's full books
that we're already at close to an hour here.
Yeah.
I apologize for
No.
Whoever has to edit.
We love passion.
I do have two questions to end on. One, speaking of the opening credits, the bus ad says, "Carrie Bradshaw knows good sex, asterisk, then parentheses, and isn't afraid to ask." What does that mean? Does that actually grammatically make sense?
I've never
What is she asking about?
The what is she asking about is the eternal question, I think. What is she? I mean, she asks lots of things every episode. I.e., are men like socks? Or I can't draw. I can't pick them quite off the top of my head. And knows good sex and isn't afraid to ask makes absolutely no sense. The asterisk and the parentheses makes no sense. Okay, so what would make sense? Like, how should they?
Isn't
say
afraid
that?
To ask about it. I guess.
She's
not afraid to ask about good sex.
I think they think the syntax works because it's like Carrie Bradshaw knows good sex. Like, not Carrie Bradshaw knows about it.
Right.
And isn't afraid to ask about good. I think it makes sense to them when you're writing it out, but it's just not good.
No. It's the kind of ad that the first time you see it, you wouldn't care, but every day when you're at that bus stop, you start getting more and more angry.
And composing letters copywriting. To the advertising company.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like I feel like they're trying to say and isn't afraid to like push people about it. Like, and isn't afraid to push the boundaries, which we find she, in fact, very much is, in many cases. Yeah, I don't know. It makes no sense. All right. It's a bad ad.
Last question for both of you to the room. Which are you, a Carrie, a Samantha, a Charlotte, or a Miranda?
So Tara is shaking her head.
None. There's nobody for me to relate to.
You didn't relate to any character at all in the show?
Miranda was pregnant when we watched it.
Sure. Oh,
of the actors, Cynthia Nixon's my favorite actor of the group.
Really?
Like Samantha, not my life. SJP, not my life. Charlotte, rich idiot. Like, no. There's no one for me. There's no one.
I will say Miranda, I think, is my favorite character and like the least annoying character. I would say Miranda is by far the least annoying character. And the one that I feel like I could most easily be friends with.
Yeah, agreed.
I really hate to say it. I used to think I can tell you the many phases of Michal understanding Sex and the City. I like really thought as a preteen, young teen, that I was a Charlotte. I thought I was this like romantic, idealistic person that was like very optimistic about love, and that I wanted something like, and that I thought I would have a very conventional life or whatever. And I'm very polite, so I'm often seen as being very polite. I abandoned that probably when I moved out of my house. At the age of 18. Not that I've moved back home at different times because my mom lives in Toronto and it's an easy place to move home to. No, abandoned Charlotte. I have never seen myself as a Samantha, although one time at a wedding, an old friend said to me, I guess I was just glowing or something. And she said, you're just giving off real Samantha energy. And it was the best compliment anyone could ever give me. And I unfortunately think I'm a Carrie because I'm not as bad with money as she is. No, I'm actually not nearly as bad with money as she is. I save my money. I save my freelance money. But I think she is curious. For all of Carrie's many, many flaws, many of which I recognize in myself, I think she is very curious about the world and curious about other people. And I see that as one of her good things. And I think even though she is at many points, you know, downtrodden and heartbroken and cynical and whatever, she actually never really gets cynical about her work or about love. And I think she always maintains some optimism even though things get, she gets herself in shitty situations and shitty things happen and she gets her heart broken, whatever, and, you know, cheats on her John Corbett, which is not nice to do. I wouldn't cheat on John Corbett. Maybe I would. Actually, no, Aiden's very annoying, and in this rewatch, I have become team anti-Aiden. But no, unfortunately, I think I am a Carrie. And it's the hair also. I have very curly hair. It's getting very long. And when I can, it will be blonde again. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Her haircut in the last episode we watched in the season 5 was excellent.
Is that when she has it short? Yeah. Yeah. So that's how I had my hair for like until the pandemic, basically. Right. Now it's like I was a teenager again. It's very long,
right?
But until the pandemic I had it like that. I love it.
Cool.
Jacob, what are you?
Her book agent played by Amy Sedaris.
Yes.
Just looking for cute guys,
just like the wacky boy obsessed.
That is one of my favorite cameos. She is She plays it to like 27. Like, she just takes
Amy
it.
Amy Sedaris is a treasure.
Just straight from Strangers with Candy to this.
Yeah.
Yes. Like,
didn't do any other work.
I will also
and then,
say.
Who was her? Kimmy Schmidt. Was she?
Oh my God.
Essentially the same character.
And she was the realtor. She was a realtor in
Broad City.
Yes. Broad City. And it was incredible.
Where she's wearing
she
the neck
up
brace.
With no shoe.
Yeah.
She's like, I lost my shoe. I don't know.
Where isn't the bathroom?
Oh, she's so good. I have to say, so there's a character we meet. Sorry to go back to that same episode. Plus One is the Loneliest Number. That's the episode where we meet Jack Berger, played by Ron Livingston, who plays this unsuccessful writer who has the same publisher as she does. And there's a later episode. So Berger and Carrie get into a relationship, and it is terrible the whole way through. But there's an episode near the end of their relationship where Carrie's book has gotten picked up for a printing in Europe or something like that. And his second book has just gotten dropped. And Amy Sedaris gets fired from the publisher. And her walking out with her box of stuff is so good. Like, I mean, it's obviously it's sad. And anytime, like, that's also a very real thing. Like, people getting laid off. Is
take the fall
the worst, but her playing recently laid off is incredible. Amy Sedaris,
there's probably a what do you call it, like a compilation on YouTube.
Definitely there's all that's the a scenes. Gift somewhere for sure.
Michal, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me, Tara. Thank you for being such a good sport despite hating the show.
I do, but I will tell you, two of the episodes we watched were back-to-back, so you know you just did the like roll through, and I'm like, I can see how like suddenly you're watching 10.
Yes.
I can see.
Yes.
We're going to convert
very
Tara.
Easy.
Is there anything you'd like to plug, or where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Michalstein2. What shall I plug?
Who's one?
I hate this so much that I made the mistake of joining Twitter in, I don't know, 2012. And someone in Israel got it before me. And let me tell you, because the only other places that there are Michal Steins is in Israel. Stein, very common last name. Michal, not common here. Very common there. I'm not related to any of them, and I don't know any of them, but I've looked at them on Facebook, and she has not used Twitter since she got it.
Oh, it's always that someone like that. Always.
I hate it. I mean, at least I would have felt really angry if I hadn't gotten my domain, because, like, what Michal Stein is going to try and get a website? Like, I know they're not doing anything, but yes, I have a very out-of-date website, unfortunately, but I do at least have michalstein.com. Don't look for me there. I haven't updated it in a year. Yes, Twitter. I also write a newsletter for Vocal Fry, so you can subscribe to that on Vocal Fry's website, which I will give you in a moment. VocalFryStudios.com.
There you go. We'll put it in the show notes, too.
Thank you. And that is where you can find me. I had so much fun. Thank you both so much for having me.
Thanks so much for saying yes.
And Tara, people can find you at Thorny HFX.
They can. And you at RWJ Boone, and the show at Box Bylines, where you just retweet whenever people talk about journalism movies.
I interact with them a little bit. A little bit. And I don't know what we're doing next week, but we'll figure that out.
We shall.
Anyway,
do.
Until then, stay between the lines and keep shipping the news.
Bye, Jacob.
Bye.